Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, and along with me, I have Kay Henderson and Kathy Obradovich in our Des Moines studio. Kay and Kathy. Hello, Kathy.
Hey, how are you doing, Dean?
Good. Kay?
Greetings.
Hello. And Chris Larimer, University of Northern Iowa political science professor, is in our Cedar Falls studio. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Dean.
And Joyce Russell is in our Ames studio. She is Iowa Public Radio State House reporter. Hello, Joyce.
Hi, Dean. Yeah.
And with me in the Iowa City studio, James Lynch, political writer for the Gazette published in Cedar Rapids.
Hey, Dean.
Well, Chris, I'm going to start off with you. Okay. And a little story here. I don't want to unnerve some of the other political reporters here, but they aren't. They think I'm going to start off with a political story here, and it's not. You do political history and a lot of research into it. This little brief narrative, I'm asking if it correlates with any political situation with which you may have knowledge. The story involves a huge ocean liner, many generally uneventful crossings. The captain, a man, very experienced, in fact, nearing the end of his career. The first officer is a woman, younger, experienced, but not as much as the captain. During this ocean crossing, this hypothetical ship received some early messages warning of possible ice hazards on the current course. And then, unexpectedly, the captain gets another assignment. Helicopter whisks him off ship in mid-ocean. And that leaves the first officer in command. Now, even though the ship has changed course because of those early warnings, new messages now keep coming about trouble ahead. And it's discovered the ship is unexpectedly running low on fuel. Now, Chris Larimer, does that hypothetical story have any political ring to it?
Well, I think it does. I think you can think about the current situation with the state executive branch. I mean, if we think about Governor Branstad as the captain who has taken a new position, was whisked away in the helicopter, and Governor Reynolds as the first captain who is stepping up to be captain, I think there are some correlations there, particularly when you think about the state budget. You know, when we think about gubernatorial politics, the state economy, perceptions of the state economy matter a great deal. And in this case, you're talking about Governor Reynolds, who has been along the way right next to former Governor Branstad's side, but now is taking over the reins as chief executive of the state. And while she wasn't responsible, directly responsible for a lot of the decisions that had been made in the past, she didn't necessarily redirect. And now she has to take responsibility, and voters are going to look to her to take responsibility for decisions. And again, the budget's the big thing that's hanging out there right now. And whether or not she can redirect around the iceberg or the current budget shortfall that the state is facing, that's going to have huge implications for the 2018 legislative session, for the 2018 elections, not only for herself, but for all state legislators who are up in 2018.
Kathy Obradovich, you like metaphors. This is built for you.
Well, I mean, so if you want to carry the metaphor on, I think that one thing that Democrats would argue is that there was a leak in the fuel tank in terms of money that had been assigned to tax credits for corporations. The state kind of lost control of the amount of those. And they did not fix that. They knew about it, didn't fix that leak in the last legislative session. One of the things that state budget experts tell me is that the amount and timing of tax credits, people, businesses taking those tax credits, is one of the big elements of unpredictability in this budget scenario. I think that fixing those things going forward is going to be a challenge because low state revenues make it more difficult to pass tax reform. Usually you need a little state money to even out the peaks and valleys that come, you know, make the winners and losers a little bit more equal when you go for tax reform. And so I think that whole budget scenario has gotten more difficult going forward.
James Lynch.
And to continue this metaphor, Dean, the people who were tasked with keeping track of the fuel and seeing how far the ship could go on that fuel didn't do a very good job of projecting how long the fuel was going to last. And even though they downgraded their projections, they still missed.
You're talking about the Revenue Estimating
Council? Revenue Estimating Council, yeah. They've downgraded their projections, what is it, 3 times this year.
Well, you're setting them up for some of the failure here then.
I don't know. There's some question about whether the process they use is a good process. House Appropriations Committee Chairman Pat Grassley raised that question during the session. You know, does this process work for Iowa? And other states are seeing similar results with their revenue projections, that they're not as steady as those projections aren't as accurate as they have been in the past. And that might have to do with the changes in the economy. Changes like, for example, sales tax revenue in Iowa, for example.
Kay Henderson and then Joyce Russell, I'm asking you, are the passengers in peril?
Well, this is Kay. I don't think the lifeboats are being deployed yet. Yesterday in Clear Lake, before the parade, the governor spoke about her decision regarding whether to call legislators back in special session to try to fix the budget dilemma, and she indicated it will be late September before she makes that decision because there are still unpaid bills that are due the state, but coincidentally, there are also tax refunds the state hasn't yet paid. So the magnitude of this problem has not yet been determined. I was fairly struck by the fact that the Legislative Services Agency, that's the nonpartisan agency that writes the bills and does the financial analysis for the legislative branch of government, identified the problem to be $104.4 million in total net receipts that were below expectations or predictions, whereas Governor Reynolds' budget director, Iowa Department of Management Director Dave Roeder, identified the problem as $76 million in cash receipts. So at some point, these two calculations will have to be reconciled.
Right.
And of course, Governor Reynolds, without calling the legislature back in session, can transfer $50 million. So it's kind of a wait-and-see game right now as to whether that's going to be enough. If it isn't, then she'll have to call the legislature back. But I would just add that, you know, the projections from the Revenue Estimating Conference, everyone knows those are projections. And some, you might argue that the problem lies in just the legislature appropriating right up to the limit of very little ending balances. And of course, you know, a few years ago, we had a $900 million surplus. The legislature and the governor agreed to some very large, long-term, multi-year commitments, including the largest property tax cut in the state's history. And now those are down. And Governor Reynolds is coming in at a time where her options are going to be limited. There's very likely that she would, when we're looking ahead to next year, it's very unlikely that she would recommend any kind of tax cut in a year that she's going to be up for reelection. And yet many would argue that the state budget has been squeezed, in education in particular, has been squeezed about as much as it can be squeezed. So she's going to have a challenge on her hands when we look at next year's budget.
Kay Henderson alluded to the Clear Lake comments by Governor Reynolds, and we have her saying that. Let's listen.
You know, there's different numbers, so we're continuing to work on that. We're watching it every day. We won't know for sure until September 30th. And as I indicated earlier, you know, we're hopeful that we can get it below $50 million. Then I can just transfer from the Economic Emergency Cash Reserve. But if not, then we would be required to call a special session. So we're going to continue to monitor it daily.
Hey, James Lynch, she sounds there like that's the last resort, is calling a special session. And why would that be? Because why don't you spread the risk among legislators?
Well, that's a good question, Dean, because it's not just a budget consideration. It's a political calculation. As Joyce mentioned, she can transfer up to $50 million from the reserve accounts to pay the bills, but it looks like that probably won't be enough. So then the question is, you call the legislature back maybe share the blame here and share the political fallout with legislators and with, you know, the way legislature is polarized. You're going to have Democrats who don't want to take any of the blame and Republicans who really don't want to take any blame either and don't want to be seen as poor stewards of the state budget. So she's really in a dilemma here. But, yeah, calling the legislature back, I think, is her last resort.
Last resort. Chris Lermer, I'd like to hear your comments on that, the political risk and all of that. And then we'll hear from Kathy and Kay. Let's go to Chris first.
Well, I guess I'd first say that I think all of you are a lot more creative in extending the metaphor than I am. But I think, you know, James is right, and what Joyce said as well, is that it really is a no-win situation for Governor Reynolds. You know, if you think back to the 2010 election, Governor Culver at the time was criticized heavily by former Governor Branstad at the time for not calling a special session, for just doing an across-the-board 10% cut, the largest cut in the country at the time. But, of course, if you call a special session and you have legislators back, as James said, you're going to be making targeted cuts. Those legislators are going to be partly held responsible for those decisions. But in the end, those decisions go to the governor for signature. And so if we know one thing about public opinion research is that voters look to the chief executive, whether it's at the state level or the federal level, in terms of holding that person responsible for the economy. So there really is a no-win situation here for Governor Reynolds if she has to call a special session, because then it's going to be her responsibility and voters are going to look to her for fixing the state budget and hold her accountable for whatever decisions come out of that special session.
Kathy?
I think that if Governor Reynolds does call a special session, there will be one item on the agenda and one item only, and that will be transferring money from the Economic Emergency Fund. She is, first of all, it's going to be too late to cut the budget for the current fiscal year. It's over. But the problem is that you can't control the agenda. And one of the things politically is that two of the people who will come back and have a forum about how bad the Reynolds Branstad administration managed the budget are two people who happen to be running for governor on the Democratic side. So I do think that, first of all, getting a deal to limit that agenda to a transfer of money will be difficult. People on both sides of the aisle will want to make a statement. But secondly, it's bad, very bad political theater for the governor.
And you agree with that, Kay, or without further comment, or you have something to add?
I think we can move on, Dean.
Okay. Well, as we look beyond that, then, in the transition in the Iowa executive branch, yeah, this is front and center. It's the elephant in the room, and that is the state's financial condition. I might also say, though, Jim, that's what the rainy day fund is for. I mean, the state is not broke in terms of looking across to the east in the way that Illinois has financial difficulties.
You're starting to sound like Terry Branstad now, pointing the finger at Illinois, Dean. But yes, you're right. There's money in those savings accounts, those rainy day funds, and that's what they're for when you have this sort of a situation. I think the downside is that there's a lot of folks out there who are looking for somebody to blame because we're coming into an election year. We're already in the election cycle. So who do we blame for this? Whether it's the governor and the governor, like Chris was saying, that's who people tend to blame for these problems. So I think that's the question there is everybody's looking to blame somebody other than themselves.
Joyce, has this been generally, though, a seamless transition with Governor Branstad off to China and Kim Reynolds now, Terrace Hill, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's largely been a seamless transition. There have been a couple of changes. The longtime director of the Iowa Department of Human Services retired. There's no reason to think there's anything sinister about that. He's 78 years old. He's had a long career in public service. He retired. And so he was replaced. That was a major appointment that Governor Reynolds made to appoint Drake Law School professor Jerry Foxhoven, who is an expert in juvenile law. And that, of course, is subject to Senate confirmation. But that happens at a time when the Department of Human Services is under tremendous scrutiny because of some child deaths and some other issues. And so I don't envy Jerry Foxhoven, but that was a fairly non-controversial appointment that she made. And then she also made two new appointments to the Iowa Board of Medicine. That's been a lightning rod of controversy there. Two of the members of the Board of Medicine the Democrats in the Iowa Senate were managed to not get those reconfirmed for their positions because of a vote on abortion that they had made. So those appointments also will need to be confirmed by the Iowa Senate. But I think by and large, I could call that a pretty seamless transition so far.
Kathy, do you think that she has a fresh start, or is she bound to the existing trajectory and Branstad legacy? And I'm going back to something you wrote. Just a little quip that came from what she said in her inaugural address, and that is she referred to stepping into big shoes, those of Terry Branstad being vacated, and she referred to she's slipping on her heels, referring to the fact that she's the first female governor of Iowa. You wrote the next day, well, I'd rather had her say not heels, but steel toed shoes, because she had big work ahead of her.
Yes. Yeah. And she has big work ahead of her, and a lot of people who are going to be trying to step on her toes was where I was going with that that metaphor. Nobody was sailing in that metaphor. But, you know, she is going to be bound in some ways and in some significant ways to the legacy of Terry Branstad. A lot of the issues that he is most associated with, she has basically signed on full force and with full support for his agenda. But, you know, as governor, things happen that are unexpected. Issues come up. Events unfold differently than they have in the past. And so she is going to have to forge her own way. And the way she's going to do that is when the unexpected happens. That's where any new chief executive, we see this in the president, we see this in governors, really shows what they're made of. When something happens that is an unexpected tragedy or something that we really have never encountered before. And I think that will be the way with Kim Reynolds. There are, though, I think some long-standing policy issues where I think she may eventually part ways with Terry Branstad. One of them is part of tax reform. Iowans can deduct their federal tax bills from their state tax returns. Everything Kim Reynolds has said leads me to believe that she's ready to move away from that to make the state's tax rates look more competitive.
And this is Kay. I totally agree with Kathy. I think that sort of going back to a moment when I was dean inside the ship of state, if you will, mm-hmm. I was on the Senate floor a few months ago, and I had a senator say that there's a pent-up desire among Republicans in the legislature to accomplish as much of their agenda in this 2-year period as possible, because they, you know, are concerned that they'll never have these majorities as they do currently in the House and the Senate, and having a Republican governor again. And so they want to take full advantage by prosecuting tax reform. In their view, this federal deductibility is a live round, and I would not be surprised at all if the 2018 legislature is considering that as their top policy accomplishment.
Jim Lynch has a comment, and then we're going to take a call from Jim and Spencer. But Jim, Jim Lynch, you go ahead.
Dean, I was going to say that to follow on what Kay was just saying, there's an opportunity here. We've talked about sort of the downside of this budget situation, but there's an opportunity here for Kim Reynolds to show leadership, to show vision, and sort of move away from Terry Branstad's shadow if she can put together a solution to this budget situation. And I think Republicans in the State House will be supportive. They don't want any blame for this budget situation, but they will be supportive of a solution that looks good enough that they can hang on to control. So I think there's that amount of support from legislators to get beyond the current budget situation.
Let's hear from Jim calling in from Spencer. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi. Okay, so I'm a small retailer here in Iowa, and I have a couple of things I wanted to mention. First of all, I've had pretty good rapport with, you know, state revenue people. For the most part, you know, they're pretty lenient, and then lately things have changed a bit. They've become what I would call a lot more callous.
How lately?
If you haven't, within the last 4 years. And
more callous
if you had an issue,
what?
Well, let's say, for example, you drop your payment in the mailbox, and because it's a holiday, it doesn't get postmarked until, you know, say, 48 hours late. Then you pay a penalty, and the thing of it is, it's not a big deal, but, you know, if you try to explain anything to these people, you know, they run you around or they put you on hold for a long, long period of time, and then you're allowed to write a letter of explanation, which is automatically rejected.
Well, Jim, is your beef with the Revenue Department of Iowa, or are you taking that across somehow into the administration of Governor Branstad?
Well, I'm thinking there's some connectivity there because just now, early in this year anyway, I get this letter telling me that I haven't paid my taxes and there's a fine, et cetera, et cetera. I spent some time working on this. I'm really confused as to what could have happened. And it's pretty rare for them to lose a check. They have done it, and I paid a fine then too. But in this case, they told me I hadn't paid them at all when they had cashed the check. And I'm wondering, is it possible that random checks would be sent out in hopes that people would pay it and not really look that closely? I mean,
okay, your question.
And here's the next thing. I've got that.
Jim,
one other thing.
I have to have you get to your point because we're running out of time here.
Well, you know, in Iowa, we have all of this online sales tax that we don't collect. Now, people are supposed to pay that, but they don't because they don't know about it. Why don't we tell them about it?
Okay. Jim Lynch, you're looking across the table at me, and you may have an answer there in a comment. Thank you, Jim, for calling from Spencer.
Well, I mean, I think if I remember right, when I was doing my income taxes this year, they ask about your online purchases and how much sales tax you owe. So I guess the state is making an effort to collect that. But I think that is a big issue. I've heard all sorts of estimates on how much money the state is losing because businesses, online businesses, retailers aren't collecting that. And there are a couple things happening. Some of the larger online retailers are starting to collect it voluntarily, and there are a couple court cases that are headed for the Supreme Court that could decide this one way or another.
So you know the Revenue Department is becoming more aggressive in collecting.
I really can't speak to that. I know they're putting the message out there.
All right. That's an interesting aspect because others are complaining also that they're not getting their state tax refunds on time. I've seen quite a few people complaining about that, but that's another matter. Right now, we're going to be breaking for some news from Dennis Reese, and then we're going to come back and talk about the Republican primary that's shaping up with Governor Kim Reynolds having some opposition to being reelected, and then also the Democratic candidates. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Dean Boren continuing River to River on this July 5th, day after the Independence Day. Kay Henderson and Kathy Obradovich. Kathy's with the Des Moines Register, and Kay Henderson's Radio Iowa's news director. They're in our Des Moines studio. Chris Larimer, UNI political science professor, is in our UNI Cedar Falls campus studio. Jim Lynch is with me in Iowa City, and Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House reporter, is in our Ames studio, and we're all convening today and assessing the first few weeks of Governor Kim Reynolds' administration and what she carries over from the Branstad administration, the challenges that she has ahead, and especially we've been talking about the budget situation during the past hour. Chris Larimer, you heard Kathy Obradovich say that she's moving away from Governor Branstad's philosophy on some aspects of taxes. Any predictions? Now, I'm getting to what Governor Reynolds has to do in establishing herself as a personality and a governing or a governor, if you will, by herself. What can she do? Would her next step really be to have the overhaul comprehensive vision in the condition of the state address next January, which convenes the legislature?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, certainly having a comprehensive, easy-to-understand policy vision will certainly help. But, you know, some of the research that I've done on Iowa governors would also suggest she just needs to be out there and establish some sort of level of comfort with voters. Now, that's not something that's very easy to quantify or measure. But, you know, if you look at the last few governors, you look at some of the tough economic situations they faced, a lot of them have been reelected, with the exception of Governor Culver. And in some of my own research and talking to voters, the reason was is that they felt comfortable with these individuals. And so when they got to the polls, they gave those chief executives, those governors, a little bit of leeway at the polls rather than simply voting them out of office. And so I think the challenge for Governor Reynolds right now is establishing that level of comfort and trust with voters. And what's hurting that hurting her ability to do that right now is the state budget situation. If that's going to be continue to be on the agenda, if it gets to the point of calling a special session, that hurts her ability to be out there to try to connect with voters. And you know, that's something she's going to have to deal with. But you know, if I was giving advice or making predictions, I would say continue to do what Governor Branstad did, what Senator Harkin, certainly what Senator Grassley did, in terms of being out in front of voters on a regular basis so they can establish a connection with her and get a sense of who she is as a person.
Chris, and I'm going to go to Jim Lynch in just a second here, but I'm going to follow up. In your research, you referred to that and going back. Are there any other similar situations that you can recall that caused you to say what you just did?
Well, there are not similar situations in terms of a lieutenant governor who stepped up to a governor and will be governor for this long before the next election. The last four cases of this were cases where a lieutenant governor stepped in for a period of days, weeks, or just a couple of months. So there aren't similar situations there, but I think you can think about similar situations for governors who face tough economic times, but you get the sense that voters were connected to them in terms of, you know, Governor Vilsack in 2002 was reelected following, and there was certainly an economic downturn in 2001. Governor Branstad in 1991, 1992 was still reelected in 1994. Even Governor Branstad in 1986. So I think, you know, having that level of comfort with a chief executive can potentially help you at the polls, but it takes a long time to establish that connection. So I think that's the challenge for Governor Reynolds right now, particularly, again, if it comes to the point where a special session is needed. You know, that's what voters are going to be thinking about in 2018.
Jim Lynch?
I think Chris is absolutely right. But when you talk about the vision, her vision for the state, that has to be put on hold while she deals with the budget. And that is going to overshadow everything, what she does on the budget.
It might even shape the vision.
It might very well shape the vision, what the state will be able to do when she addresses the legislature in January. In the meantime, I think she has to go, you know, my advice to her would be very simple, three words, possibly four, depending on how you count them, 99-county tour. Go out there and sell whatever her budget solution is to Iowans. Make them feel comfortable with her and the solution, because what Chris is talking about is people trusted Governor Vilsack, even though there were some tough economic times. They trusted Governor Branstad through those tough economic times. And the vulnerability that Governor Culver had was that Republicans exploited the budget situation, where he came in and said, we're doing a 10% across-the-board cut, and they attacked him on that. And to a large degree, that was his demise.
Mm-hmm. Joyce?
Well, and I think that she is. I think she realizes that she has to be out there and relating to people, and I think she's very good at it. She got a lot of experience with that under Governor Branstad. She, you know, she went to all 99 counties, just like the governor did. I think she's very personable. People seem to like her. People gather around her in the little bit that I've seen her now that she's governor. But I think that Jim is right that she hasn't yet, so far she's just the booster, and she hasn't yet had to say, okay, this is a hard thing we're going to have to do, and this is why.
And
so,
Kathy,
so she is untested in that way.
Thank you, Joyce. Kathy and Kay, she's going to be traveling to overseas here for this fall yet.
Yeah, you know, she's going on some trade missions, and you know, this is something that she is experienced with. One of her first duties as lieutenant governor, after she was first elected, was to fill in for Governor Branstad on a trade mission to Asia. So, so she is. This is something that she knows how to do. And going to China, you know, where Governor Branstad is now the U.S. ambassador, gives her an opportunity to perhaps exploit that new strengthened relationship with China to perhaps. You know, bring home some good news on economic trade for Iowa. So, so I do think that this is a positive thing for her to be doing right away. And also, again, you know, anything that she can bring back to the state that's good news economically, I think people will respond positively to that.
Okay.
Well, I've been thinking about the 1994 gubernatorial race and how state employees participated in the GOP primary in a way that was unprecedented and hasn't occurred since. They voted overwhelmingly for Fred Grandy in hopes of dislodging Terry Branstad. You have Democrats running around the state running for governor who feel energized and as if they can run on a platform of wasn't Terry Branstad and his accomplice, in their words, Kim Reynolds, horrible in passing the labor-related laws that took effect this year, namely the workers' compensation changes and the way in which collective bargaining was changed. Whereas if she is in a primary with Republican voters, those two changes are very positive with Republican voters. And so she's not going to have the same kind of problem that Terry Branstad had in 1994, because Democrats are going to, by and large, stay at home and vote in their particularly crowded Democratic primary. The interesting thing about the primary that she faces is she faces a couple of people who are not well-known statewide. Ron Corbett may be known in Cedar Rapids, but I don't know that he's very well-known in Shenandoah and Burlington and Dubuque and Lamar's. So she enters the primary season, which is, you know, the first hurdle she will face as governor, making the case to Republican voters who by and large buy into the Branstad agenda that she has inherited.
Is there a party deference, Jim Lynch? Is there a party deference to the Reynolds incumbency among the Republican Party establishment?
Yes. Officially, the party is saying it's going to be neutral in a primary, that it will won't take sides. I don't know that ever really happens when the party has an incumbent in office. They certainly don't want to lose that incumbency. But yeah, I think maybe where it will show is in the donor base. And in the folks who work on campaigns, they've worked for Terry Branstad in the past. And it appears that Kim Reynolds, and either through her campaign organization or through the Branstad organization, they've locked down the support and the fundraising network that Terry Branstad enjoyed for all those years.
Well, Chris Larimer, as you study campaigns, and we've alluded here to the challengers to Kim Reynolds, but Cedar Rapids mayor and former state legislator, we can't forget that. Kay said he's not very well known statewide. That may be he has traveled. He's tried to get himself out there and introduce himself before he even announced. And he has been a state legislator, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, but probably not known outside the state legislature and back in Cedar Rapids for a number of years now. He's 56 years old. Governor Kim Reynolds is 57. And the other person is Boone City Councilman Steve Ray. He's 46 years old. He has 30 years in state employment and county law enforcement. Those are the two people who are challenging Kim Reynolds. Now, what I'm asking you, Chris Larimer, is what must Corbett and Ray do to diminish that Reynolds incumbency advantage?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult. You know, political scientists often, for a number of decades now, have a ranking of a strength of the challenger, and it starts with, has the person held elected office? At what level have they held elected office? Has it been local, state, statewide? And so, if her challengers are people who have not, who maybe have had some elected office experience, but it's been localized, it's not a statewide name recognition. That's a big challenge for her challengers. I think certainly going around the state, as was suggested, and you mentioned Ron Corbett's been trying to do that. I think that's certainly part of what he has to do. But part of it may be a bit of hope that Governor Reynolds stumbles a bit, that the budget situation does not turn out as she hopes it does, that there are some difficult issues that a special session is called, and that people start to question her leadership ability, because I think it's going to be difficult, right? If we just go on name recognition and strength of the challenger, it would seem Governor Reynolds is in a very strong position.
And Joyce Russell, I like your comments on this as well, because you've covered the state legislature. You've been involved with these personalities. You were there when Mayor Ron Corbett of Cedar Rapids was in the state legislature. Is this a sort of a delicate thing within politics, because attacking the Republican incumbent and trying to differentiate yourself there as a candidate is very, very delicate, isn't it, for Ron Corbett?
Sure. It's always hard for someone to challenge, to have a primary against an incumbent. That's always difficult. And I think that there's quite a bit of an enthusiasm out there for Kim Reynolds, in part because she's the first female governor. She's coming behind a very popular governor, Terry Branstad. And I think the only way that she can be brought down, I believe, is if Republicans can make the argument that Democrats are so unhappy about what they call the disasters of the trifecta at the statehouse this year, that they're going to be so motivated to get a Democrat into the governor's office that Kim Reynolds is going to be vulnerable, because she's the public face of those terrible things that happened at the statehouse this year. I think the problem, in part for Democrats, is they don't have a standard bearer yet. So, they can't make the point that we are really going to go after Kim Reynolds because of these terrible things that happened at the statehouse this year. So, sure, it's really hard for a candidate to challenge an incumbent, and it's especially hard this year, I think.
Kathy Obradovich, Joyce has led us into the Democrats' dilemma as well, and they have some problems of their own. That is, not just with a number of candidates and being able to differentiate among the candidates. They have a leadership vacancy right now at the Iowa Democratic Party, and they have some fractionization, let's put it that way, within the party itself. So take any one of those as far as the Democratic challenges, as far as being able to make inroads into Terrace Hill.
Yeah, as timing goes, it's probably not the worst possible timing for party chair Derek Eden to resign for health reasons, but we're getting close to that time when it's difficult. I mean, he has been traveling the state trying to work on unifying the party at the grassroots level. There are still a lot of fractions related back to the 2016 primary between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And, of course, we are about to have Bernie Sanders back in the state again. So we'll see if his presence helps bring that party together, or if it just reopens the old wounds from the 2016 campaign. At the same time, we do have a very large field of candidates who are, at this point struggling just to be known. None of them are really very well known statewide. Even the former state party chair, Andy McGuire, she has had a statewide exposure, but she's just not, none of them are very well known. And we've got people coming and going in the field. You just mentioned that Michael Mattson has dropped out, and new people are coming in to the to the race all the time. So it's going to take a little while to settle that down.
Very fluid situation.
Yes. One thing that we are seeing so far, by and large, a very positive, issue-focused primary. It's not necessarily – it may be anti-Republican, but it's not right now. People are not ripping each other apart. That will help the party, when they finally come to a nominee to hopefully be able to rally around one person.
Having a weak party – this is Kay Dean – isn't necessarily the death knell for a candidate. I'm thinking back to the 2002 race in which Iowa Democrats changed party chairs just a couple of months before the general election. Mm-hmm. And what happened there was you had a strong candidate in Tom Harkin who had an apparatus, and you had a candidate in Tom Vilsack who built an equally strong apparatus of his mm-hmm. own. Regardless of the machinations that were happening at the party level. And so for Reynolds, she will benefit from a Joni Ernst who has set out to build a broad grassroots organization. She's held a very popular yearly fundraiser in Boone and Des Moines to try to keep connected with her supporters, keep them enthusiastic, keep getting their email addresses so that they can be tapped into. And she will share that with Kim Reynolds. I'm not sure that party apparatus is the death knell for a candidate.
The thing is, though, Kay, this is Kathy. Democrats haven't figured out who their new Tom Harkin is going to be. And I think that what we saw over the last couple of cycles has been in part due to the fact that we haven't necessarily had Tom Harkin helping recruit the candidates, help shore up weak spots in that organization. And they're going to have to find that new – some people have said that new sugar daddy, that new, if not titular head of the party, but at least the leader that everybody looks up to in the party.
I haven't promoted the call-in number, and if you have a comment, you're listening, and you have a question, we're coming to the end of the program, but if you have a quick comment, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100 will get you here, and we'll try to get you on the air before we leave the air. Now, Jim Lynch, there are a number of candidates who are either announced for a Democratic nomination. And we heard the challenges. Who's in and who's out there? Are all of them, Andy McGuire, who's the former Democratic Party chair, announced early on, and then a number of them announced and or some have indicated they'd like to announce?
Yeah, the field, actually, I think there's been about 10 people who have been in at one time. I think we're down to 8 right now as a couple people have decided against running. It's a long time until the primary in June of 2018. Some other people may drop out. I've heard some Democrats talk about maybe some of these people should be running for Congress rather than for governor.
Uh-huh.
I guess it depends on what congressional district they live in, whether that makes sense or not. There could be more people joining this race. There are some people, some names there that surprise me that they're in this race, but when it's wide open like this, why not jump in and see what happens?
Well, I go to Chris Larimer on this. One name that surprised me was the president of the local union, Service Employees International Union, SEIU, a nurse in Iowa City, Kathy Glasson. But then I find that SEIU across the country, Chris Larimer, is trying to capitalize on the current fervor, the protest fervor, and urging their members, their union leaders, to get involved and to run for public office. Any comment on that? Any observation?
Well, I would say this. I think it makes sense on at least one level. When you think about gubernatorial politics, what predicts higher approval ratings for governors, it really comes down to two things: presidential politics and perceptions of the state economy. So if we think ahead to 2018 and what presidential politics are going to look like, for a governor who has shared party affiliation with a very popular president, that can be a good thing. But if you're going into 2018 and President Trump's approval ratings continue to be, low 40s, high 30s, he's in low 40s, high 30s, say, in the state of Iowa in 2018, that could potentially drag down whoever the Republican nominee is in November, if it's Governor Reynolds, whoever it might be. So that's the one, you know, that's an opening for Democrats. And so I think, you know, it makes sense maybe to try to capitalize on some of that fervor that's going on around the country. And then, of course, you know, we still don't know on the economy. That's what we started off the show talking about, the budget, the economy. Those are two things that could potentially work to the Democrats' favor.
Well, we're coming to the end of the program here, and I want to say thank you to Kay Henderson, Radio Iowa's news director, Kathy Obradovich, Des Moines Register political columnist, both in our Des Moines studios. Chris Larimer just heard from. He's UNI political science professor. Jim Lynch has been with me in Iowa City, and Joyce Russell, the Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent, has been talking from our AIM studio. Thank you very much, gang. It's always fun to hear your comments and to get together with you.
Thank you, Dean.
Thanks, Dean.
Today's River Derby, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Statton. Technical assistance of Dennis Reese in Iowa City, John Pemble in Des Moines, and Nick Brinks in Ames. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is produced by Iowa Public Radio News.